So we're going to begin now with the actual book itself, the spiritual canticle. Now what it is it's a lyric poem in the form of, the technical word is an eclogue. That's a poem that contains dialogues. And in this case, it's dialogue describing the loving exchanges that take place between the human spirit and Christ, the bridegroom. It's very obvious that in many places, the dialogue there is between the soul of St. John of the Cross and Jesus. Now, why did St. John use poetic form? Well, he gives the answer when he says that the stanzas are expressions of love coming from, quote, mystical understanding. A better word would be infused knowledge. It's his personal experience of God within him and the knowledge that he has through that. They are the outpourings of a soul deeply touched by divine love. St. Teresa also speaks of occasions when a soul feels the need to express the overwhelming fullness of a mystical experience in poetic form, even though they do not have poetic talent. From her life, we have this quotation. The soul would desire to be all tongue in order to praise the Lord. It utters a thousand holy absurdities, striving ever to please him who thus possesses it. I know a person, she usually means herself when she says that. I know a person who, though no poet, composed some verses in a very short time, which, full of feeling, described her pain very well. They did not come from her intellect. Now, this word, mystical understanding, elsewhere in his prologue to this work, the Spiritual Canticle, our saint speaks of mystical wisdom and mystical theology, and he also calls it contemplation. In the work itself, there's a quote I'm giving. He says, in contemplation, God teaches the soul very quietly and secretly, without its knowing how, without the sound of words, and without the help of any bodily or spiritual faculty, in silence and quietude, in darkness to all sensory and natural things. Some spiritual persons call this contemplation, and they call it knowing by unknowing. In other words, there's a knowledge put there, and the person doesn't know how it was put there. They did not arrive at it through reason, but it's there. That's what we call infused knowledge. Now, he also talks about this knowledge being secret and hidden. And from his work, we're quoting here, this knowledge is not produced by the intellect, which philosophers call the active intellect, which works upon forms, fantasies, apprehensions of corporal faculties. Rather, it is produced in the possible or passive intellect, and I would say by intuition. Now, here I'd like to stop to explain this. This is Thomistic philosophy, we would call it. The way we're made in the spirit part of us, there is an intellect and a will. And within that intellect, there is a memory. According to St. Thomas, there are only two faculties. The memory, St. John of the Cross makes it a separate faculty. But the memory is part of the intellect. Now, as our intellect works, and as we gather knowledge from outside of us, like I'm looking at this speaker, the image of the speaker is transferred from my eye to the imagination, which is made to reflect within itself what you see outside. Now, the imagination presents it to the intellect. The intellect breaks down what's material out of it and takes only the idea of what makes a microphone a microphone. The color, shape, whatever, substance, the material, whatever is made, is not transferred to the intellect, just the idea. So it's spiritual. This is what he's talking about when he talks about the active intellect. It's that part of our mind that grasps the spiritual part of the material things around us, like a chair. The color of that chair and the nature of its wood, material, whatever, is all in my imagination as I look at it. But my mind, the active mind, works on what makes a chair, the idea only. That is transferred to the active intellect. This is what we call the reasoning mind. See, the part we call reason. The other part that he calls here passive, that part of the mind that doesn't have to work to arrive at a knowledge, it grasps a thing right away. Like one and one make two. We get it right away. So there are other things that we can reach suddenly through a kind of an immediate knowledge. Now that's the part of our mind that God gives information to. See, he puts it there by his presence and his activity. And we call that intuition, say. Now he says this passive intellect receives passively only substantial knowledge. That means ideas that are stripped of material images, which is divested of images and given without any work or active function of the intellect. Now I'm adding here, this mystical understanding is hidden and secret because it avoids reasoning and meditation, has no sense image from which the ideas are drawn. Because this knowledge is invested with sense images, a person will find it very difficult to describe spiritual knowledge given to him. St. John explains further, quote, since the wisdom of this contemplation is the language of God to the soul, of pure spirit to our spirit alone, all that is less than spirit, such as the sensory, that fails to perceive it. Consequently, this wisdom is secret to the senses, to the imagination. See? It's in the mind, but not in the imagination. And it's not in our reasoning mind either. Now, it's also darkness. This contemplation is also called a ray of darkness because it gives knowledge or light, but this knowledge is hidden. It is not clearly understood. It is darkness to the intellect because it is a light so bright that like the sun that darkens the eye by its brilliance, so the light of this contemplation overwhelms the intellect, giving an impression of darkness, like looking directly at the sun and your eye is suddenly dark. Not because there's no light, because there's too much light. Now this knowledge is received by faith, and it is supernatural, because it is produced by God's action or the Holy Spirit within the soul. And God is the object of this mystical knowledge, and it is supernatural in the manner in which it is given, namely, not by our reasoning process, but by receiving it by contemplation, intuition. It's also love. Besides being knowledge and wisdom, this mystic understanding is a loving knowledge. Now, a quotation from St. John. Since God communicates this knowledge and understanding in the love with which he communicates himself to the soul, it is very delightful to the intellect, since it is a knowledge belonging to the intellect, and it is delightful to the will, since it is communicated in love, which pertains to the will. It is God who in this state is the agent, in other words, who does the activity, and the soul is the receiver. The soul conducts itself only as the receiver and as one in whom something is being done. Therefore, it's passive, see? God is the giver and the one who works in it by granting spiritual goods in contemplation. The goods are knowledge and love together. That is a loving knowledge. Without the soul's natural acts and discursive reflections, for it can no longer engage in these acts as before. Later on, we'll talk about that. In other words, when they begin to pray, they can't pray anymore like they used to. They can't use their reasoning mind, meditate on, Lord, what were you doing in the garden, and so forth. It's a kind of a mental conversation. We call that reasoning. They can't do that anymore. Their mind is kind of bound, and they've got to pray only in this way, by being still. On the question as to whether knowledge causes love or love causes knowledge, that's a big question among theologians. He admits that normally knowledge brings about love. In other words, you can't love what you don't know. See, normally that's true. But he also says that love causes knowledge, and it is in reference to the loving knowledge that comes from God as a gift to the soul that this love causes knowledge. The bridegroom calls this love of the soul a breeze, because it proceeds from the contemplation and knowledge that she has of God at this time. That's true, in the sense that I've heard this from on a number of occasions. A person will say, I wasn't thinking of God, but suddenly within me there was a love that welled up, and there was no thought there, but it reminded me of God right away. In other words, the love was there before the knowledge was there. Now, continuing this thought, properly speaking, our saint says, God does not communicate himself to the soul through its flight. And by that word flight, he means the knowledge it has of him through its own reasoning and faith, but through the love it has from this knowledge. So throughout the canticle, the spiritual canticle, the knowledge communicated in contemplation causes love, and love in turn is the reason the Lord communicated more abundant and profound knowledge. This knowledge is called experiential. In other words, one not only knows, but at the same time experiences this love. Because of this experience, this knowledge is a certain knowledge, not in doubt. It's certain, though it is given without ideas or images. Since the soul experiencing this is aware that what she has so sublimely experienced remains beyond her understanding, she calls it, I don't know what. See, these are expressions he's using in his poem. Since it is not understandable, it is indescribable. Although, as he says, one may know what the experience of it is. For example, in stanzas 14 and 15, where the soul tastes or experiences in God in one of the very intense and lofty communications that are given her by the Lord, the mystical understanding has varied degrees of intensity and spirituality. And then other expressions that come up. The expression of the ineffable, something that cannot be put into words. With the above explanation, we can understand why St. John of the Cross chose to use lyric verses as the best way to express what in reality remains beyond words. The way our saint expresses this experience remains his work of art and is the creation of the poet. Still, the mystical understanding and experience will influence the creative activity of the poet. One certain source of this canticle, spiritual canticle, is the Canticle of Canticles, the Song of Songs. It provided the theme and the pastoral surroundings. And then he talks of a loving communion or an exchange. The lyric poem of the spiritual canticle presents a loving conversation between St. John of the Cross and Jesus. So this journey of love is the heart of the poem, and this love is considered as a constant growth in holiness. It is this constant progress in love that sustains the action of the poem, that gives direction and structure to the stanzas. The development of the poem is evident in sections of stanzas that present important situations and occasions in the soul's growth in divine love. Now we're going to break down the stanzas into several groups. In stanzas 1 to 12, the bride, that means our spirit, whether male or female, is called bride. The bride goes in search of her beloved by learning many things, but is never satisfied. It only increases her longing for the Lord. Stanzas 13 to 21, now the soul sees him in the distance. He is for her. A number of varied experiences mentioned in poetic terms, the mountains, lonely wooded valleys, strange islands, silent music. That term was used by William Johnson, the Jesuit, for his book on the mystical life. Tranquil night, and so on. But the bride and her beloved are not entirely free from disturbances. St. John uses other poetic words, foxes, deadening north wind, lions, stags, fears of the night, and so on. Stanzas 22 to 35, finally the bride enters the sweet garden of her desire, laying her neck on the gentle arms of her beloved, and in the wine cellar of perfect love, drinks of her beloved. You couldn't put that except in poetic terms. Stanzas 36 to 40, in the end, she wants to go with her beloved to the high caverns in the rock, where he will give her the vision of his beauty in glory, namely the beatific vision. So there are four main divisions of this life of love put into this beautiful spiritual canticle. The first is an anxious search in love for the Lord, the beloved. The second is the first encounter with him, the spiritual engagement, which is not perfect union. The third is perfect union with the bridegroom, or what is called the spiritual marriage, a life of love in the state of perfection. And the last is a desire for perfect union and transformation in the beloved in glory. That's heaven. Now the dates of the composition, stanzas 1 to 31 were composed in prison at Toledo. Stanzas 32 and 39 were probably at two distinct periods. When he was a prior at Granada, the one verse 11 was added later on when the second commentary was written. Now the commentary, in addition to the poem, he commented on each verse and each line. Obviously, no one could understand the rich imagery unless St. John of the Cross explained it, which he was asked to do by the Carmelite nuns at Beas, who were the first to read the poem and were astounded by the beauty of the verses. So John began to explain the verses first in conferences to the sisters, and later on in writing at the request of one of the holiest nuns of that reform, close associate with St. Teresa of Avila, Blessed Anne of Jesus. She's not canonized, but beatified. In his commentary, John indicates that the basic order of the poem corresponds to the personal experience of the poet, and the plan of it indicates the common path that a soul follows on the road to spiritual perfection. Later on, as he sought to give a more orderly analysis of the development of the spiritual life, he rearranged the stanzas to give them a more chronological order. This revision became a second commentary. It's also called the second redaction. In your copies, as you'll get them, you'll find that. The doctrinal value of the poem was enhanced by this second commentary, though the poem suffered some in its spontaneity and inspiration. Now, the elements of the commentary. After the stanza follows a general summary of its meaning, intended to highlight the content and its connection with the previous stanza, or the one that follows. Then there is a detailed explanation of each line. The doctrinal explanation is there to justify the theological teaching in the verses. And then there are introductions placed before most of the stanzas, molding them into a complete whole. They're found in also the second commentary. Now, the second commentary, there cannot be any serious doubt that that second commentary was composed by the saint, and we'll use it because it is clearer than the first. It's also better arranged and more valuable from a doctrinal or teaching point of view. And then the outline, before we're going to give the first verse now. The outline is first, stanza 1 to 12 would be the state of beginners in the spiritual life. But mind you, a beginner according to St. John of the Cross, not St. Thomas or not any other saint. He has a system of spirituality. And by the way, my book there, you have Spiritual Maturity for Contemplation. That would be a must for this work because it gives you an idea of what he means by beginner. So be sure and pick up a copy. It'll help you understand his system of spirituality. Stanzas 13 to 21 is the state of those who are advanced. And it's there that the spiritual engagement, we'd call it, or betrothal takes place. It's called another word is illuminative way. Then stanzas 22 to 35 is the state of a soul in perfection. It's a unitive way where the spiritual marriage takes place. And then 36 to 40 is the state of the beatific vision. So we begin now with stanza 1. I'm not using the book because I've typed it right into the notes. The verse stanza reads, "Where have you hidden, beloved, and left me moaning? You fled like the stag after wounding me. I went out calling you, and you were gone." Now, the introduction. The point of takeoff on the road of love to union in love with God is described here by St. John of the Cross. This particular soul has come to the realization of its spiritual obligations, that life is short, the road is narrow, sees the things of the world as vain and deceitful, and all comes to an end. The account is strict. Salvation is difficult. Also realizes its immense debt to God because it is created for him alone, redeemed solely for himself, and owes him every response in love. Moved with dread and sorrow over so much loss of time and spiritual growth, and the danger of losing him, the soul renounces all things, puts aside all business, does not delay another moment, sets out with loving sighs and desires, wounded with love for God, goes in search of him. That's a description of a conversion. Now the commentary. Here the soul is in love with the bridegroom, Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Where have you hidden? Now the meaning here is, show me where you are hidden. Here he gives the soul a feminine term. He says, here she wants the evident presence and vision of God's divine essence, which alone will satisfy the soul. In this life, God is a hidden God. And a quote from him, however elevated God's communications and the experiences of his presence are, and however sublime a person's knowledge of him may be, these are not God essentially, nor are they to be compared to him, because he is still hidden to the soul. Neither is the sublime communication nor the sensible awareness of his nearness a sure testimony of his gracious presence. Nor is dryness and the lack of this a reflection of his absence. A person actually cannot have certain knowledge from the one state that he is in God's grace, nor from the other. In other words, in consolation or dryness, that he is not in God's presence. Many people feel that way, like they begin to pray and it's cold as ice, and they're dry, and there's darkness, can't even put two ideas together. Why is that? Is it because they're a sinner? Well, if there had been a devout person that this comes upon them, no way. Does it mean that God isn't there? No, it doesn't. That's what he's saying. The wise man says, no one knows if he is worthy of love or abhorrence before God. See, not by these sensible signs. Here the soul is not asking for sensible devotion because in it there is no certain or clear possession of the bridegroom in this life. But the soul asks for the manifest presence and vision of his divine essence, which will give it security and satisfaction in the next life. Yet the soul needs to find the bridegroom and be united with him in this life through union of love as far as possible, and the place to find him is within itself. John says, the Son of God, together with the Father and the Holy Spirit, is hidden by his essence and his presence in the innermost being of the soul. To find him, one must leave all things through desire, affection, he says, and will. Enter within himself, in itself, in deepest recollection, and see things as though they did not exist. God, he says, is hidden in the soul, and there, the good contemplative must seek him with love. So then, the soul, or he's addressing the person, so he says then, soul, you yourself are his dwelling at his secret chamber and hiding place. All your good and hope is so close to you as to be within you. You cannot be without him. It brings special happiness for us to know that God is never absent, not even from a soul in mortal sin. How much less from one in the state of grace? What more do you want, he says, for within yourself you possess your riches, delights, satisfactions, fullness, kingdom, your beloved. Be joyful and gladdened with him. Desire him there, adore him there. But there is one difficulty. Though he dwells within you, he is hidden. Faith. Why do I not find him or experience him? To find the beloved within the chamber of our soul, the saint says, you should forget all your possessions, namely detachment, and all creatures, and hide in the inner secret chamber of your spirit, closing the door behind you, namely your will, not desiring anything. You should pray to your Father in secret. Remain hidden with him, and you will experience him in hiding, and you will love and enjoy him in hiding, delight with him in hiding. By imitation of the perfect life of the Son of God, her bridegroom, the soul will merit to be brought to the high perfection of union with the Son of God, her spouse, and transformation in him through love. In this union, she experiences such closeness to him and is so well informed and wise in his mysteries that the soul no longer has need to say, where have you hidden? Another help to find the beloved is, as our saint says, to seek him in faith and love, without desire for the satisfaction, taste, or understanding of any other thing than what you ought to know. Faith and love are like the blind man's guides. In dealing with these mysteries and secrets of faith, the soul will merit through love the discovery of the content of faith, namely, Jesus Christ, the bridegroom. And even though the soul reaches the highest state of union and love in this life, the beloved is still hidden from her in the bosom of the Father, which is how she wants to enjoy him in the next life. Therefore, to seek God as hidden, we exalt God immensely and come very near him when we consider him higher and deeper than anything we can reach. Pay no attention to anything your faculties can grasp. Never desire satisfaction that you understand about God. Never stop with loving and delighting in your understanding and experience of God. But love and delight in what is neither understandable nor perceptible of Him. Such is the way of seeking Him in faith. Always regard Him as hidden. The less distinct is your understanding of Him, the closer we approach Him. In drawing near Him, you will experience darkness because of the weakness of your spiritual eye. So at all times, in adversity and prosperity, whether spiritual or temporal, consider God as hidden. What he's saying there is that as our mind begins to think about God and his presence, in its own way, it will begin to put him into pictures. That is not God. Whether it's the Father with a beard, that's not God. Anything your imagination can cook up is not God. Any idea that you can apply to God, that's not God. It's an idea about God, but it's not God. That's what he's saying. So your faith must come into play. And you must say, my God, I believe you're here. Then God is there, but not necessarily in your ideas. But as a being, he is present. Your faith and mine can make God present by an act of faith. And then the real being is there, but your mind cannot contain it. Do you understand that? So it's hidden. Okay? It's hidden. But how precious that is. So all the thinking that we've done before this, and all the images you can create, is not God. He says, don't get lost in that. Don't be attached to it. In pure faith, an act of faith that says, my God, I believe you're here, then reach out to that reality that you can't see or picture or image, and be with it in love. That is pure faith. And that is God. But you have no idea of what he's like. Now, he says, beloved. The soul addresses God as beloved to move him the more to answer her prayer. When God is love, he very readily answers the requests of his lover. And our saint says, and this is John the Evangelist, if you abide in me, ask whatever you desire, and it shall be done unto you. John 15:7. Nothing is obtained from God except by love. Remember the little flower saying in the end, nothing counts except love. And then the words of the verse that he has, and left me moaning. The absence of the beloved causes continual moaning in the lover. She loves nothing outside of him, finds no rest or relief in anything. This is how we recognize the person who truly loves God, if he is content with nothing less than God. Our saint says the soul bears this moan within herself, in her enamored heart. There where love wounds is the moan rising from the wound, and it ever cries out in the feeling of his absence. Especially when the soul, after the taste of some sweet and delightful communication of the bridegroom, suffers his absence and is left alone and dry. And then the words of the stanza, you fled like the stag. The Canticle of Canticles, chapter 2, 9. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Our saint says he usually visits devout souls in order to gladden and liven them, and then leaves in order to try to humble and teach them. Well, isn't that true in your own experience, your early days? If you can recall when prayer was so consoling, God was present. You had there was a consolation there. There was a presence there that was sweet and delightful. And then you left the church and wherever you were praying, and first thing you know, we're back into the grind again on the merry-go-round. It didn't last long. And then the line, after wounding me, he usually bestows some secret touches of love. Like fiery arrows, they pierce and wound it, and leave it wholly cauterized by the fire of love. These wounds are called wounds of love. The fire of the love within it makes it go out of itself and entirely renews it and changes its manner of being. Again, think of the baptism of the Spirit. If not you, people that you know, whole life was changed. There was a love for the Lord, it was just eating them up. And they didn't do anything to earn it. It was there. These are called spiritual wounds of love and are very delightful and desirable. The soul would desire to be ever dying 1,000 deaths from these thrusts of the lance, for they make her go out of herself and enter into God. She explains it in this way, and he goes into the next line. I went out calling you, and you were gone. These are two ways of going after God. One, departing from all things by contempt for them. He means by detachment. He doesn't mean sell your house, give up everybody else, go out into the desert and be alone. Well, for us to go out of the desert, we'd have to fly a couple thousand miles. What he means is, in your heart, leave all things. See? Don't be attached to them. Detachment. Pull yourself away from them. The second is going out from oneself through self-forgetfulness achieved by the love of God. When a person is in love, they're not thinking of themselves. It's the object of love. So when God is that object, then they're not thinking of themselves. They're going out of themselves to the one loved. In this verse, the soul is saying, my spouse, in that touch and wound of your love, you have not only drawn my soul away from all things, but you have also made it go out from self. It even seems you draw it out of the body and have raised it up to yourself while it was calling after you, now totally detached, so as to be attached to you. And then the final line of that stanza, and you were gone. At that time, at the time I desired to hold fast to your presence, I did not find you. And the detachment from one, without attachment to the other, left me suspended in air and suffering without any support from you or from myself. The loving soul lives in constant suffering at the absence of her beloved, for she is already surrendered to him, hopes for the reward of that surrender, the surrender of the beloved to her. Yet he does not do so. Now, lost to herself and to all things for the sake of her loved one, she has gained nothing from her loss, since she does not possess him. I hope you can understand that. Now, this is a fervent soul that has decided to give up all things and goes after the Lord and is willing to do anything and everything for him. It has been touched by the Lord and is filled with that love because it couldn't begin to do this. But the Lord doesn't choose to be caught. So it's left this side. It's going out there, but it's not there yet. So it's like in midair. It's nowhere, apparently. And that is a very trying state to be in. And that's why he says, and you were gone. Now, don't you see that he's describing a spiritual state that's very difficult to put into words, but easy, relatively easy, in poetry. Well, I'd like to stop there for some discussion. Are you able to discuss? I should have said before this, and hereafter I will remind you. We'll all put on our space suits and our space helmets, and we'll take off into the spiritual stratosphere. Well, I'm sure it made some sense to you. Yes.
Well, I think your reading and explaining it to us, perhaps suffering that troubles you, that either gone through or have been or whatever, and have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
At least by your explanation, they have some idea of what's going on. Because those periods of being left or dry, whatever you want to call them, are pretty horrendous if you don't understand. At least,
mm-hmm.
say, to be an educator, so we'll not only expect them, but when they do happen, realize that you are correct, that you're not deserved, that God is maybe closer to you than you ever were before.
Yeah, it's very consoling to know that. And yet to feel, see, we say feel because we are going by our emotions. And that is a bad guide in the spiritual life. A bad guide, remember that. When you don't have feelings where God is concerned, it doesn't mean he's deserted you. And that's the time to pray in pure faith. And that is very precious to God. Well, and then to know, too, that God is a pure spirit. So you cannot reduce him to feeling. As a spirit, we do, but we also have a spirit. And the Lord ministers to the spirit part of us, not to the feeling part of us. Because if he stoops down to our level, then you might say that's the lowest fringe of God, as it were. It's not God, really. Because God cannot be, as it were, put into our feelings. He's too big for that. But when he is spirit, and he comes to us as spirit, to our spirit, that is the closest kind of communication we can have. Then there is an overflow from that into our body when God chooses to minister that way. But when it is in its greatest experience, a spirit to spirit, and there is an overflow, the body suffers. There is what they call a rapture. The bones are dislocated, and person suffers for months after that, because that kind of communication is too disastrous for the body. St. Teresa of Avila speaks of that. So you see, God is even very kind to us when he comes to us in faith, rather than in our feelings. And it is not God at his best, you might say, to reduce him just to our feelings. But we need it. See, we need it in order to urge us on and gradually lift us up higher to God's level. So he stoops down to our level, way down. Comes to our feelings first. Then gradually we're taught that feelings are not necessary. That's not God as God. It's our spirit meeting him on his level and through faith that enables us to meet God as he really is. And that's where the greatest communications are, the most trustworthy, less susceptible to misunderstanding, and also less able to be interfered with by Satan. Satan can affect our imagination, but not the intellect. And under cover of that, God hides from us, as well as Satan, what he's doing.
That was your last reading. When he touched that soul, but then he made himself unavailable. The soul's out in midair searching. And that's the way I can, which you're explaining. But the soul's not quite ready to be reconciled with God.
No, it's a beginning stage. First stanza, the first to the 12th. Verse. See, that's the beginner stage. And there's a whole series of steps to be taken. This is the journey, see. In other words, we're talking about any devout person who is in search of God. So now here they are, staff in hand, they're marching along the road. Okay? It's a long path. It's a lot of potholes and...
direct, I have never seen him in a picture.
I've always felt him within me, but I've never, people have asked me, have you ever seen the Lord?
Mm-hmm. Well, by Lord, they would mean Jesus Christ, because he had a body,
yes.
See? And even that is not the Lord. That's an image in our mind that could be created by God to give us an image of the Lord's presence. See?
Can't you see the Lord in creation?
You do see some part of his beauty. See, that's what you mean. That's what you mean. Some part of the beauty that is in God. Yes. Yes, things that happen. They're permitted by God or directly willed by God. They're part of, in other words, God's providence, as we call it, his care of all that he created. We call a birth of a child an act of God, don't we? Mm-hmm.